of course, interest rates remain high as we bring down inflation. But because of the progress we've made, because we are delivering the Prime Minister's economic priorities, we can now help families not just with temporary cost of living support, but with permanent cuts in taxation.
We're waiting longer than ever for hospital appointments. Our kids' schools are literally crumbling, and homelessness has skyrocketed in the past year. This week's spring budget was a vital chance for Chancellor Jeremy Hunt to respond to the huge problems our country is facing. But instead of trying to fix any of our problems, the Chancellor announced a cut to national insurance that will benefit the richest households 12 times more than the poorest. So, what did Jeremy Hunt's announcements mean for people across the UK? Why are the opposition talking about maxed out credit cards again? And what needs to happen to save our public services and boost living standards for all? Welcome to the New Economics Podcast. This week we're asking, will the spring budget fix our broken economy? I'm Aisha Thomas-Smith. Stay with us. Week, we're keeping our guests in the NEF family, and I'm really delighted to be joined by Hannah Peaker, Director of Policy at the New Economics Foundation. Hi, Hannah.
Hey, nice to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. And I'm also thrilled to be joined by Lydia Preig, Head of Economics at our very own New Economics Foundation. Hi, Lydia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's jump in. We're going to begin with what looks like the big story coming out of the budget. So Jeremy Hunt has announced he's going to cut national insurance by an additional 2p. So Lydia, can you tell us what this means for people living in the UK?
Yeah, so he's going to cut the basic rate of national insurance from 10% to 8%. And that's on top of the national insurance cuts that he already announced at his previous budget in the autumn, where he cut the rate from 12% to 10%. So these national insurance cuts, they will be of greater benefit to the wealthier proportion of society. So for example, the wealthiest 20% of households will be receiving on average an additional £1,700 a year as a result of these combined cuts across the two budgets, whereas the poorest 20% would be receiving only an additional £136 a year. So the wealthiest receive on average 12 times more from this cut. And that's because of things like they're more likely to have two members in work, and also because of things like your benefits get reduced if you're on universal credit that's topping up your income. So as you get more income from the tax cut, you lose part of that due to your benefits also being reduced. And these effects, they play out across the UK as well. So London and the Southeast, which is where you get more of the wealthier families, they're going to see more of the benefits than other parts of the UK. So there's a levelling down angle to these cuts as well. And I think there's an interesting comparison to be drawn with regards to, you know, the cost of these cuts over, say, the next 5 years is going to come to about £100 billion. And that is for tax cuts that are going to increase inequality. And if you compare that to the total amount that the government has pledged in investment spending on something like levelling up across the entire programme, so that's running from 2020 to 2033, so across 13 years, actually the amount they'd be spending on these tax cuts over 5 years would be more than double the entire amount of investment spending on the levelling up programme. So it says a lot about the government's priorities.
Indeed. So we've got the income disparity plus the geographical disparity there. It's been reported that this tax cut combined with the previous national insurance cut that we've seen will, you know, cost the government around £21 billion a year. Hannah, what impact will this have on paying for the things we need, as Lydia was saying? So, you know, NHS, schools, local authorities. Can you give us a sense of the state of living standards in the UK right now and how this will impact it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a simple thing. Tax cuts are paid for through spending cuts, right? So some departments, of course, are protected from those cuts, such as the NHS and defence. But that, in a sense, means even harsher cuts for unprotected things like justice, where we know there are like extraordinary waiting times for people's court cases to be processed, creating immeasurable trauma for victims of crime, such as sexual violence, and cuts to things like local government, things that really matter to people's day-to-day, transport that's reliable, potholes being filled, bins being collected, like all of those types of things that really are how people experience the economy, that's where you're going to start to see some of the harshest cuts. And so public investment will be cut by a further $18 billion in real terms by 2028-29. And so what you're going to see is a further contraction of public services. And all the polling around this suggests, you know, that that's not actually what people want. They didn't want the tax cut. They wanted investment in their public services. And in terms of where we're at with living standards, you know, average earnings for working families are £2,400 lower in real terms compared to the start of just 2021. And you're seeing everywhere prices continuing to rise, rents and mortgages going up. Remembering that every day, thousands of people reach the end of an existing mortgage arrangement and find they have a much higher rate for that. So where Lydia is talking about those tiny amounts going back into the pockets of the poorest people, you can see that that's not in any way going to stack up against all of those rising prices. And it's going to be at the expense of our public services. A lot of people came out in the week preceding the budget to talk about how, and people from, you know, different political traditions, different ideas about the economy, were kind of unanimous in their agreement that we just can't cope with more cuts to public services. And these additional cuts are looking like what we saw, you know, between the early days of Osborne and that initial round of austerity. But layering that onto a decade of austerity, I think we can't really imagine kind of how bad that's going to feel. And we're obviously, you know, very worried about it.
I want to come back to talking about the austerity agenda in the second part of this podcast, because I think, as I alluded to in the intro, what we've also seen here is a reintroduction of the discourse around public credit card and these kind of things, which I think is really important to drill down on. But, you know, it sounds pretty dire at the moment. Lydia, were there any positives that came out of this budget that we can feel good about?
So there were a few relatively small tax changes that were welcome. So, for example, the government has significantly scaled back the generosity of its non-dom tax breaks. So prior to today's announcements, for 15 years of living in this country, you could try to not pay tax on your overseas income by using the non-dom exemption. And that's been scaled back now to 4 years. So that's obviously a significant improvement. I ideally would have liked them to have gone farther and scaled it back even further, but it's a good step forward. There were a few other things. So for example, they've abolished relief on furnished holiday rentals. So those are things that would be like Airbnbs, which obviously can cause problems for local communities. And they also scaled back relief on multiple property purchases, which once again is a welcome step, but they could have gone further. So for example, they could have done things like increasing stamp duty on people who own multiple properties or overseas buyers, because the relief they exempted today was only for people who buy multiple properties at the same time, whereas a stamp duty charge on multiple property ownership would be much more effective in terms of making sure the right people are able to buy houses.
So it seems that there's kind of quite a lot of tinkering at the edges there, but not really any kind of substantial moves in the right direction. But as you said earlier, Lydia, there's been a lot of things that will have a very direct impact, not only on the inequality side of things, but also on the public services.
I also wanted to just pick up on something Lydia said there, because what the Tories were doing with the non-dom policy is taking on a policy which for a long time now they have ridiculed Labour for having. And this was a complete switch on that, suddenly embracing a kind of flagship Labour policy, having kind of argued it was unworkable before now. And that's not insignificant. And I think that is both a sign of desperation because of the constraints that they've placed themselves under economically, or placed us under economically, but also it shows a level of cynicism. Like, a lot of this is about laying traps for Labour, about taking away, raising measures that Labour had planned in order to meet its spending plans. And, you know, I just think the public reading that are just finding the whole thing really cynical. A budget not about people, not about helping us out of the situation we are currently in, not about supporting the people with the least, but playing political games. And I think it would just be ultimately off-putting.
One thing that was really notably absent in this budget was anything on the climate crisis. And I know quite a lot of people were shocked at that. So, you know, of course, it's not going anywhere. Hannah, what are we to make of the Chancellor's total disregard of the climate in this budget?
There wasn't nothing, but it was completely nonsensical what there was. You know, they announced that they're going to freeze fuel duty. And, you know, that will provide almost no help to struggling households and instead puts our net zero goals under threat. And of course, again, like the other things we're pointing to, it's wealthier households that tend to drive bigger cars, make longer journeys. It also, by the way, is men that tend to make those longer journeys. And while poorer people and women are much more reliant on the very public services that will be cut to pay for that continuing freeze. So you had that on the one hand, that will encourage continued carbon emissions. And then at the same time, the Chancellor said, I'm going to extend the windfall tax. But the problem with that is, in the original windfall tax, what they baked in is loopholes for oil and gas firms. And those aren't being removed. So the government will still be giving away, you know, we estimate potentially up to 20 billion in tax rebates through those loopholes to some of the richest energy companies in the world, which is really galling to see your own energy bills go up while these big companies are profiting. The other problem with this extension of the windfall tax is that we're seeing that globally energy prices are now starting to come down. And so that the kind of tax receipts that he's counting on may never actually materialize unless, you know, what we need probably is right now to act with an immediate and higher windfall tax if you want to actually bring in those tax receipts and put that meaningfully towards bringing people's energy bills down or investing in the green transition. But there's no plan for that. So illogical on the environment, hugely disappointing. And actually, I don't even think it will materialise the advantages that he claims it will.
And as you say, the windfall tax there, another one, you know, perhaps stolen, borrowed from Labour. But as some of the discourse around this, you know, people are kind of saying perhaps this is somewhat of a temporary budget that's putting certain things in place. And that means that we can anticipate a May election. What do you reckon, both of you?
I mean, I've been much the irritation of the NEF team in Camp May from the outset. I haven't really heard a persuasive argument for why it will be later on. I think the thing that everybody sort of fundamentally doesn't account for is this isn't like previous elections. I think that the idea of recovery is gone. And so why would you delay? Things are going to get worse. You know, I think they're back, they're counting on a kind of, can they get a plane to Rwanda off the ground? And can they get inflation down to the target level of 2%? But they've seen with some of these other moments they were counting on, halving inflation, for example, it hasn't given them the bump that they were hoping for. And their culture war politics also hasn't succeeded in returning different election results. So I don't understand the logic. The only thing I suppose you could say is there are enough people who have a self-interest who would lose their seats if the Conservative lost power, that there's a kind of delusion that comes with that, that you think, oh, we'll just hold on for as long as we possibly can. But I can't really understand it. I mean, one read I heard of what's kind of gone on with the budget is that this, because it wasn't popular with voters, the national insurance cut, you weren't seeing that polling well. Why were they doing it? Well, part of it was appeasing the right of the party, which was putting significant pressure on around tax cuts. And maybe there's an idea there about, well, by doing this, it was seeing off the idea of a leadership challenge. And therefore, you could argue you're hoping for an election in the autumn instead. But I'm sticking with May. I don't know where Lydia's at, but...
Yeah, Lydia, what do you reckon?
Well, we are officially in a recession at the moment. And obviously that was announced relatively recently, but is expected to be a relatively short and shallow recession. Although I would add living standards and GDP is expected to stagnate pretty much over the next few years. So my hunch is they will try to minimise the amount of seats they will lose, even though I agree with Hannah that they're obviously not going to get like a big bump in the summer when we're no longer officially in a recession, or if the Bank of England get round to cutting interest rates and inflation has reached the 2% target. I don't think it's going to result in a big bump for them, but I imagine they'll play it safe and try to minimise the losses and wait until we've got that better economic news.
We shall see. We shall see. Okay, so Let's dive into the austerity hotbed once again. Feels like that's we spent a lot of time there on this podcast, but over the last few days, you know, we've heard a lot of terms like fiscal rules, fiscal headroom, and the Labour Party's accused this government of maxing out the country's credit card, amongst other things. So, Lydia, let's start with you. If you could explain what this language is referring to and tell us whether you think this is a useful way for us to think about the economy.
Yeah, so the maxing out the credit card analogy, I mean, governments love to use it because, you know, people can understand it. And also for political reasons, you know, if you're politically inclined to perhaps want lower government spending, then this is a good way to frame that, because it's very much framing the narrative that taking on debt is bad and will only lead to bad things. What it doesn't take into account is the fact that if I as an individual increase or decrease my spending, it doesn't really have any impact whatsoever on the wider economy because I'm just one person. But the government is a giant entity, and if it increases its spending or decreases its spending, that has enormous impact on the wider economy. For example, if it increases spending, it creates jobs, it puts income in people's pockets, and then they go out and spend in the economy, and that generates new jobs and income for other people. And so it creates what economists call multiplier effects, which is why the analogy with a household and maxing out your credit card is bad, because it doesn't take into account those effects. And it leads to situations like we're in at the moment, where we are being told, because of fiscal space, which is basically the amount that the government could borrow in order to stick to very strict self-defined fiscal rules, which are things like reducing debt to GDP over the course of 5 years, you know, we're being told that because of that, the government isn't able to invest, when in actual fact, by investing, we'd be able to help boost the economy, because the economy is in desperate need of investment. And actually, over time, that could help reduce the debt to GDP ratio, because you'd be growing the economy.
So what we have really here is a government saying our hands are tied by decisions that we've made based on logic that we're not really sure that anyone agrees with.
That's right. And Aisha, I don't know about your credit card, but mine also has a spending limit on it, which this government, of course, doesn't have. And also, I can't print money.
Yeah, or borrow money in your own currency from a bank you own. So that would be nice.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. And I think also you've seen kind of the further effects of those narratives. And narratives are really important. You know, one of the parts of the political picture that we're looking at is the group that both parties really are courting in this election, in the marginal seats, the so-called red wall or the working to man or whatever description you want to give of that person. There's two things that are common about those voters. One, they're really economically insecure. And the other is that they're highly disengaged from politics. And so what parties are attempting to do is you need to have repetitive messages that really cut through to actually reach those voters and engage them in what you're offering. And so framing really, really matters, and it really shapes discourse. And we, you know, at NEF, we have this challenge all the time, also working with our colleagues across the new economy space. Beyond this, there's also journalists will typically talk about tax burdens. Well, that changes immediately how you think about taxation, right? And that it's a burden rather than a contribution to public services that we all rely on. Like, all of these framings start to build a picture. The Conservatives are really good at framing economics in ways that makes it accessible to people, but that also has consequence for how we think about what's an acceptable policy and economic plan, and that can be really, really damaging.
And of course, I plug this probably every podcast, but the fantastic Framing the Economy project, which was done by NEF and NEON and PERC and a bunch of other organizations, the PDF of which is still available for free online, really goes into detail on a lot of the metaphors that get uploaded into our brain when we talk about the economy and how we can start to shift that. So, lovely listener, do check it out. Moving swiftly on, Hannah, I want to talk to you about how this budget interacts with Labour. We, of course, have the issue that you raised earlier around people saying that this is a kind of cut and run budget that is laying traps for Labour. So I want to hear a little bit more about that. But also, with the general election on the horizon, whenever it may be, the Labour Party will, of course, have to make some big decisions about how it responds. And so, yeah, top lines on what we think a Labour's budget response would look like, or what we would like it to look like. Maybe starting with you, Hannah, and then Lydia coming to you.
Yeah, that's right. And it's sort of, you know, building on what we just said, it's a case of everybody pointing the blame. It's that meme when everyone's pointing at someone else, right? Because the Tories are saying we've been backed into this corner, and then Labour will say we've been backed into this corner by the Tories, which to some extent they have. But again, Labour hasn't set its fiscal rules yet, and we'll be hoping that they don't make the same mistakes with that. But of course, some of this stuff does set traps in quite meaningful ways. One of the early examples was their announcement on childcare, which took away from Labour a kind of wedge issue. Also, committed to them to vast amounts of spending, which in my view aren't spent very effectively on that childcare model. There's much better ways to do that. And there's a sort of a sense of, you know, once that's enacted, that path, it's hard to undo, and or just taking money out the system so that Labour can't meaningfully deliver on whatever it intends for its election promises. But I would also push back on that and say what's wide open here for Labour is to come out and say, this doesn't make any sense. It's not a sensible way to think about our borrowing. And so therefore, as a government inheriting this situation, following a huge unprecedented cost of living crisis, we are going to borrow, and we're going to borrow to spend smartly. And at the same time, we're going to tax wealth in the way that we tax other forms of income in this country. And in combination, those two things, in whatever form they take, would give them the space to be able to do the kind of transformative investment we so desperately need. And yet, what we've seen from the Labour's response to the Chancellor today, it's sort of mocking and saying, you know, you've left us in this terrible situation, but at the same time saying we wouldn't undo any of those tax cuts. So there's becoming a very thin line between the economic policy of the two main contenders for this election. And that's really disappointing to see, because what we need is transformational change.
Lydia, what would we have liked to have seen from an opposition government in response to this budget?
Well, I agree with Hannah. I mean, I would have liked Labour to just take a completely different approach, not just at this budget, but with their rhetoric, you know, over the past, you know, year or so. They've really boxed themselves in by saying that they're not going to, you know, raise taxes beyond a few small tweaks. And simultaneously, it looks like they're going to impose fiscal rules that are really quite similar to what the government is proposing for the next few years. And it's just going to mean that they're going to have to preside over 5 years, if they get in, of declining public services, or even more declining public services. So, you know, instead, I would have wanted to have seen them acknowledging that the fiscal rules as they currently stand, which are very simplistic, they don't take into account the complexity of fiscal space and the fact that debt to GDP is just not a particularly good measure of safe levels of government borrowing. It's a far more complicated problem. It would have been great to have seen an acknowledgement of that, and something like NEF's proposal, which is to replace fiscal rules with independent fiscal referees, for example, based at the OBR, who could help hold the government to account on what might be a range for safe levels of borrowing from government. The government would obviously have final say over that, but they would have to explain if they fell outside that range. So it would be a way to have fiscal discipline and acknowledge the fact that you can't literally borrow forever. Obviously, there are limits, but it would be doing so in a way that's not overly simplistic, and you're actually targeting something meaningful, because you're taking into account the complexity of this, how much can a government safely borrow question. So, you know, that would have been fantastic, and it would have been great to have pledges from them of an accompanying sizable investment programme to make up for the 14 years of chronic underinvestment that we're suffering from, and the fact that it's expected to heavily weigh on the economy for many years in terms of the economy is going to continue to stagnate, and we're going to struggle to get out of this slump without that sort of investment programme. And as Hannah alluded to, that could be paid for not just via borrowing, but also via progressive tax rises, which they shouldn't be afraid to talk about.
Yeah, I was just going to say as well, like, if Labour is determined to commit to that arbitrary debt to GDP target, there are still things that they can do, such as extending the time period over which those fiscal rules apply. They want a vital economic renewal programme. Well, you can't do that in 5 years. And I understand that we feel constrained by that being the political cycle, but just in terms of seeing that out, stretching that out, we could extend the time horizon of OBR forecasts as well, start to look at actually, because some of the benefits of this stuff are realised beyond the period of the forecast. Like, let's factor that in, let's change our viewpoint on this.
So let's finish then by talking a bit more about those alternatives that we could have seen that you just kind of started dipping into, Lydia. You know, instead of a chancellor who's chosen to lay political traps for his opponents rather than, you know, take people's lives in the UK seriously, let's end on talking about what we would have liked to have seen from the budget. And also, if either of you could humour me, I would really like you to kind of also drop in a kind of behind the headlines, you know, what you might have missed about the budget. Because I often find so much, gets swept under the rug. And you have, when folks are reading about this online, what they're going to see is 2p tax cut, 2p tax cut. What else should they be looking out for? The good, the bad and the ugly.
I want to see critical and urgent investment in housing. We have a homelessness crisis. We have a housing crisis. There is not a day that goes by that we do not see headlines about the number of people living in temporary accommodation in a wealthy country and economy. It's just unforgivable that that is the case. And it would make a significant difference to how people are experiencing the cost of living crisis, because for most people, it's taking up too much of their income, what they have to pay out on housing costs. So that would have been my absolute top priority, a new generation of homes at social rent to make it genuinely affordable to people.
And there was something in there about building more houses, right? But it wasn't the right type. We had Sheffield, Blackpool, Liverpool, and something about Canary Wharf.
Yeah, and generally we go in this kind of, vague definition of affordable, which, you know, can still come at 80% of market rates. Like, what we need is homes with social rent that are really affordable for people, so they're not feeling so squeezed. But also we need it at scale. This is not like a small problem that you can have by building a few houses here and there. This is a national issue. You know, we talked a little bit about London and the South East benefiting. Well, to be fair to those areas, also they face some of the most acute housing crises because the costs are so high. And so we need this across the country. We need it for every region, tailored to the needs of those regions, but it needs to be the mainstay of the next government to build those homes.
Again, we kind of have a tinkering at the edges approach here, it seems. Lydia, what do you reckon?
So in answer to your question about what are the additional things about the budget that might not have grabbed the headlines that I would draw people's attention to, firstly, I would flag that there was very, very little from a cost of living crisis. So there was, a small increase in some of the discretionary funding, so continuing it for an additional 6 months, for example. But it was basically an element that was missing from the budget in a significant way. And what I would have liked to have seen were announcements that would be tailored to specifically people who are most vulnerable to the cost of living crisis. So things like removing the two-child limit for universal credit, or the benefit cap, or reducing the taper rate for people on universal credit so they'd lose less of their income when they are working. Things like that would have been much better measures and the tax cut that we got announced. And I think it's important to remember that even though inflation is going down, prices are still rising. And for many people, the cost of living crisis is still really real. And we've got something like 4 in 10 households struggling to afford the essentials, and over 4 million children living in poverty. So it's something that should have been more addressed in the budget, but wasn't. The other thing I would flag is that while the Chancellor boasts that public services spending overall will increase by 1%. You've got to take into account that a lot of that will go on the protected departments, so things like health, education and defence. And when you look at the unprotected departments, they are actually going to be seeing really significant cuts over the next few years, as we talked about a bit earlier. So the cuts could be as much as around 3.3% over the next few years. So there's a really sizable cuts that the head of OBR himself has even questioned, like, are these really feasible? They're so large. And highlight in terms of what could have been done better, the progressive tax rises I would have liked to have seen would be things like properly equalising the rate of tax that we pay on wealth versus the rate of taxes that we pay on income. So looking at the dividends rates, looking at the capital gains tax rates, and also closing gaps in the national insurance system, because national insurance is basically a very bizarre income tax with all sorts of exemptions. So investment income is exempt. People above pension age who are still working, they are exempt. Got a very low top rate of tax, extraordinarily low. And all these changes could have been addressed to make national insurance a more progressive system.
There's been some fantastic work that's come out of Tax Justice UK today in response to this that, again, I'd encourage listeners to look out for and really kind of diving deep into what these tax cuts look like and mean as part of a larger kind of agenda.
I had one thing, which was that there was like a small thing that tried to course correct. So the government obviously made a big announcement about expanding childcare, paid for childcare, and it's not going to happen because there aren't enough providers and providers are shutting down. So they made a slight correction to that today by making a better settlement and better offer to providers. I still don't think it will go far enough, but it was the right thing to do to kind of course correct on that if they want in any way to expand the childcare offer in this country. So
interesting.
Look out for that.
Yeah. I mean, and we'll see, I guess, if by the time it comes in, we've had an election or not. Who knows? Who knows? But that is all we've got time for on this episode of the New Economics Podcast. I hope it's been as enlightening for all of you listeners as it has been for me. Hannah, thank you so much for joining me. If people want to find out more about your work, where can they go?
Still on Twitter, at Hannah Pika, and I unfortunately got at Hannah Pika 1 for my account, so
whoa,
see me there, right?
Good. Well, Pika numero uno on Twitter. And Lydia, same question, how can people track you down?
So I'm also on Twitter, at Lydia Preig. I don't need to compete with anyone for my name. Makes sense, easy. And then, of course, I also publish blogs and things on the NEF website as well.
Lovely jubbly. That is it for today's New Economics Podcast, but we'll be back soon with more. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell someone about it. To find out about becoming a NEF supporter, you can visit neweconomics.org. The New Economics Podcast is brought to you by the New Economics Foundation, produced by Katrina Gaffney, James Rush, and Margaret Welsh. I'm Aisha Thomas-Smith. Stay safe.